And it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And let's start off with our announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having their restoration this Saturday, November 6th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. down at Sunset Beach State Park. And hopefully it won't be raining too hard. It might be a sprinkle, but you never know. Fall is here and there's plenty to see at Sunset Beach, especially along the back of the four dunes. Splashes of marsh baccharis, burr marigold, swamp knapweed, and marsh gum plant. We will continue our efforts on removal of summer mustard and wild radish while enjoying the beautiful scenery. Come on out and spend some time helping to restore this lovely place. How to get to Sunset Beach? We'll basically go east on Highway 1 for about 9 miles out of Santa Cruz. Take the San Andreas Road exit. Go towards the ocean on San Andreas for 5 miles to Sunset Beach State Park. Doesn't look like much, so make that right-hand turn. Tell the folks at the kiosk that you are there for habitat restoration and get a parking slip for your vehicle, and they will meet you at the south end of the parking lot. That's at the lower day-use parking area at the south end. That'd be right near the beach. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. But if things do get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and water. For more information, contact their program leader, Linda. Her number, 462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Or contact her by email at redwdrn, that's redwoodrn, at packbell.net. Or go to www.cruisecnps.com. .org for more information. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. On a week from Monday, beginning November 15th and lasting through February 15th, wild buffalo that migrate into Montana will likely be shot by hunters. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks are holding another hunt without habitat, a hunt for a species that is ecologically extinct in Montana. 44 state tags to kill bison have been issued for areas north and west of Yellowstone Park. And if there is a normal winter migration, an additional 100 wild bison could be killed in this canned hunt. Montana's bison hunt is highly controversial, as yet another tool Montana is using to stop wild bison from migrating into the state. This canned hunt does not replace hazing, capture, and slaughter activities, which are still carried out under the Interagency Bison Management Plan and are used in addition to it. Hunters who participate in Montana's bison hunt are being used by the Montana Department of Livestock as yet another tool of intolerance against native wild bison. And at least two First Nations, the Nez Perce and the Confederated Salish Kootenai tribes, will also be hunting buffalo under treaty rights, though their season will differ from that of Montana. In addition to our year-round presence in West Yellowstone, the Buffalo Field Campaign will again be present near Gardner, Montana, on the north side of the park. Our Gardner camp will remain active for as long as the hunt is underway or longer should the buffalo need us to stand witness. During the hunt, Buffalo Field Campaign will engage willing hunters in dialogue to talk about the threats wild bison face in Montana and how they, the hunters, can help take a stand to restore this magnificent gentle giant throughout its native range. Since our last update, brucellosis has made appearances in a few livestock herds far from the current home range of America's last wild bison. Brucellosis is a bacteria that was brought to North America with the arrival of Eurasian cattle. While it hasn't been a significant health issue since the advent of pasteurized dairy products and hasn't been a threat to wildlife outside of livestock industry politicos, brucellosis has been a driving force behind bad wildlife management decisions throughout the Yellowstone area, including the ongoing slaughter and harassment of the Yellowstone buffalo herds. Despite these efforts, three cows from a Wyoming cattle ranch tested positive for brucellosis last week. It was just a matter of time, as that cattle ranch is located near an ill-conceived government-sponsored elk feeding grounds. Wildlife advocates have been trying to shut down these feedlots for many years, but have been met with resistance from ranchers who favor them because it keeps wild elk off the native habitat currently occupied by You guessed it, cattle. Shortly after this news, Montana papers responded by announcing that they intend to capture and test up to 500 wild cow elk. That ought to be fun. We have warned that it will not only be a matter of time before Montana livestock interests set their sights on elk in addition to buffalo. Lastly, just the other day, one of Ted Turner's domestic bison herds was found to have, you guessed it, brucellosis. These bison, or more correctly called beefalo, came from Ted Turner's Bozeman area Flying D Ranch, just a stone's throw from where the quarantined Yellowstone buffalo now reside on Turner's Green Ranch. There is absolutely no chance that the quarantined buffalo stolen from Yellowstone when they were wild calves are a source of the infection. These incidences are more critical bits of evidence that wild buffalo are not the source of brucellosis transmissions to livestock. There has never been a single documented case of wild bison transmitting brucellosis to cattle, even during the decades prior to the heavy-handed tactics carried out under the Interagency Bison Management Plan. In the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, the combined governments of Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana, along with the U.S. government, are wasting taxpayers' money by focusing on containing the natural migration of wild buffalo, phasing out Wyoming's feeding grounds for elk and acquiring habitat for both bison and elk would be far more effective uses of taxpayer money. Livestock production is a common denominator of trouble, whether it's bison, elk, wolves, bears, water quality, grassland health, or human health. Cattle are also the most obviously manageable element. The only reasonable solution is to shift the focus on to controlling them and ensuring that they are not a threat to our wildlife and our wild places. You want more information? Contact the Wild Buffalo Field Campaign. They are a wild bunch. They're at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. And if you're going to be volunteering with them, and that's a very interesting thing to do, if you like cold weather, go to their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org and check out what it means to be and how you get to be a Buffalo Field Campaign volunteer. And if you have any further questions after that, call 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. And give them a call. Once again, the website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the Sinixt Nation establishes a protection camp on their land. On October 26th, the Sinixt Nation, and these folks are up in British Columbia, asserted their sovereignty over by initiating the Sinixt Shlu Sevenkin, or Perry Ridge, Protection Camp on their ancestral lands. The Sinixt, by declaration, have established the Sinixt Shlu Sevenkin Perry Ridge Wilderness Preserve to protect the rich biodiversity on Perry Ridge and the collective domestic watershed interests of the Perry Ridge community. Sinixt Nation members, local residents, and supporters are gathered at the beginning of the Perry Ridge Forest Service Road near the town of Slocan, British Columbia. The camping has halted all commercial logging in the area. After a complete refusal to consult with the Sinixt Nation, British Columbia Timber Sales via the British Columbia Ministry of Forest and Range sold the logging rights to four controversial cut blocks on Perry Ridge to Sunshine Logging Limited of Caslow, British Columbia. Sunshine Logging purchased the two-year contract for approximately $330,000 Canadian, I presume, after BC Timber Sales dropped the auction bidding price so no companies wanted to touch the highly contentious contract with a 10-foot pole. This isn't the first time people have taken a stand to protect the area known as Shlu Sevenkin to the Sinixt. In 1997, local residents, the Perry Ridge Water Users Association, and Sinixt members took both legal and direct action and successfully halted road building on the ridge. Over 300 people blocked the road, demanding protection for the area. Known as the Arrow Lakes Indian Band under the Indian Act, Canada officially declared the Sinixt extinct in 1956. This left Sinixt members living on the Colville Reservation in the United States or scattered among the other nations in British Columbia without recognition. Many Sinixt returned to the northern part of their territory to protect their ancestral burial sites in Vallecan, British Columbia in the late 1980s, when a British Columbia minister... When a British Columbia Ministry of Transportation road development project desecrated their burial sites, removed bones and artifacts, and placed them in museums. After a tremendous amount of effort from the Senext and their supporters, remains of their ancestors were returned to them and reburied at the site. The Senext to this day continue to live peacefully and reoccupy their land in Vallecan, making it the longest reoccupation in Canadian history. Senext territory spans from the headwaters of the Columbia River north to Nakupsk to Kaslow in the west, Revelstoke in the east, and down into what is now known as Washington State. Over 80% of the territory lies on the Canadian side of the 49th parallel. In British Columbia alone, 15 dams were built on Senext territory. In 1954, Kaiser Aluminum proposed a dam on Arrow Lake. The Keenly Side Dam flooded 140 Senext cultural sites, which is probably why the Canada declared the Senext extinct 2 years later when it flooded. The Conoco smelter at Trail built a dam on the Kootenay River by near the ancient Senext village of Kaputils. Too many apostrophes in there for me. The zinc and lead smelter has since dumped over 13 million tons of toxic slag, including mercury, into the Columbia River. And a visitor to the Columbia Basin will be unlikely to see any indication there was ever a native culture that thrived for so long in this region. Most of the Senext traditional villages and burial grounds were flooded with the damming of the Arrow Lakes. We know of only one monument to the Senext. In the town of Edgewood, there is a totem pole that was erected in the late 1960s. It was commissioned by British Columbia Hydro as a commemorative to an extinct race. But the fact of the matter is that the Senext never had totem poles, and they aren't extinct. The Senext Nation and their supporters are encouraging people to help out in any way they can. Can you make any financial donations payable to the Senext Nation Society? Mail well-concealed cash, money orders, and checks to Senext Nation Society, RRI G-I6 C-2 Winlaw, British Columbia, VOG 2J0. And for more information, and if you want a background on the whole thing, visit http://senextnation.org. That's SINIXTNATION.org. senextnation.org. And I do hope they can keep their timber and their water safe. And in big news for people who visit federal forest lands, the Forest Service has lost a fee payment case in federal court. And listen up if you visit federal national forest land. And I don't know if this applies to the BLM, but I know it definitely applies to Forest Service. An important decision has been handed down by federal magistrate Judge Mark Aspey in Flagstaff, Arizona. He granted a motion by Sedona resident Jim Smith to have his ticket for failure to pay a Forest Service recreation fee, that is, to have a Red Rock Pass, dismissed. Jim parked overnight in the Voltree Arch Trailhead, a dirt parking lot with no amenities, accessed by a rough dirt road. He backpacked into the Coconino National Forest, camped in an area with no amenities, and returned to find a ticket on his car because his car did not display a Red Rock Pass. The Red Rock Pass fee program is one of the most notorious in the nation, requiring an access fee for 160,000 acres of federal public land, most of it dispersed undeveloped backcountry. Jim challenged the Forest Service's authority to levy a fee at Voltree Arch Trailhead because the law governing recreation fees specifically prohibits fees for parking, general access, walking through federal land without using facilities and services, camping in dispersed undeveloped sites, or in any location that does not offer reasonable access to six specific amenities. The area that requires a fee must have a permanent toilet, a permanent trash container, a permanent picnic table, developed parking, that means paving, interpretive signage, and security services. That means the ranger has to come out there and check on it. The Voltree Arch Trailhead offered none of those amenities. It only serves as a place to park and enter undeveloped backcountry, both of which are activities the law says must be free of charge. The nearest toilet is 7 miles away, and the nearest trash can is 10 miles away. Jim represented himself and was up against the full might of the federal government, but he won because he proved to the judge that the way the Forest Service is implementing fees in the Red Rock Pass area is not a reasonable interpretation of the law. In fact, the decision describes the Forest Service's interpretation as absurd, and this is the judge's language. In addition to the plain language of the statute prohibiting the Forest Service from charging for parking or access or undeveloped camping, and the plain language of the statute prohibiting the Forest Service from charging an amenity fee at a site where specific amenities are not provided, congressional intent and legislative history indicate that the Forest Service's construction of the relevant statutory section would thwart congressional intent and result in an absurd construction of the relevant statutory scheme. This is a very important decision with national implications. There are almost 100 places around the country where the Forest Service has created high-impact recreation areas, or HIRAs. Within a HIRA, they have been claiming the authority to charge a fee for any activity at all, as long as the six amenities exist somewhere in the HIRA, no matter how scattered or how far away. This interpretation has resulted in visitors being charged fees for access to millions of acres of dispersed, undeveloped backcountry. Judge Aspie says nixed to all that, among other things, his decision renders moot the signs in the Red Rock Pass area that say you have to buy a pass to park anywhere in the National Forest, and it makes it unlikely that the Coconino or any other National Forest can ever again successfully prosecute someone for not having a pass at trailheads or dispersed camping areas. Now, I do want to give you a warning. Do be aware that you may have to take the Forest Service to court to enforce this, because they're not gonna back down gracefully. But U.S. versus Smith is the one you want, and so let them know that you know about the U.S. versus Smith decision, and they can't charge you money for parking in an undeveloped parking area. And if you get something called a Notice of Required Fees, or an NRF, tear it up and throw it away. It's useless. Okay? Now, that's not to say you should tear up a Notice of Violation, just a Notice of Required Fee. If you are not in a developed campsite or picnic area, then you can't be charged for parking at a national forest. And I think it also applies to BLM land, too. Moving on, Argentine judge bars some glacier protection rules. In this story by Luis Andres Henao, editing by David Gregorio for Reuters Thompson. An Argentine judge has ruled that key articles of a glacier protection law cannot be applied in San Juan Province, where Barrick Gold Corporation is building a large mine, an official news agency said on Tuesday. Mining industry analysts had warned that the new law could hinder construction of Barrick's Pascua Lama mine, although the company says the ore body it has permission to mine does not lie under a glacier. The glacier protection law bans mining and oil drilling on glaciers and in the areas surrounding them. San Juan Judge Federal Judge Miguel Angel Galvez, ruling on a complaint presented by mining industry groups, suspended the application of six key articles of the law in the San Juan province, the judiciary's news agency said. Daily La Nación quoted him as saying provincial governments had the constitutional right to decide how to manage their natural resources. The judge suspended the article banning activities that could affect glaciers, as well as the part of the law that defines glaciers. President Cristina Fernandez vetoed a similar law 2 years ago on the grounds it would hamper growth of the provincial economies, causing controversy in a country where anti-mining sentiment is strong. The new law was passed in September. Barrick, which also runs the Veladero mine in San Juan, said it was not surprised by the federal judge's ruling. We are not surprised by this decision, given the province already has legislation in place that protects glaciers, to which Barrick is in full compliance, company spokesperson Rodrigo Jimenez said. And we'll see how that one plays out. And a judge asked the United States to review its polar bear listing in this story by Timothy Gardner, with editing by Javier Briand of Thomson Reuters. A U.S. judge has asked the Obama administration to clarify whether polar bears are endangered, a listing that ultimately could be used to force polluters to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan asked the Interior Department for more information on whether the bears, which are losing Arctic sea ice habitat due to global warming, could be considered endangered instead of just merely threatened. The move came after environmental groups challenged a 2008 decision by the administration of President George W. Bush to list the bears as threatened, a ruling the Obama administration upheld last year. If the Interior eventually decided to list them as endangered, the bears would get full protection under federal law. U.S. oil refiners, coal-burning power plants, and other polluters of greenhouse gases far away from Alaska could get sued for contributing to global warming and be forced to cut emissions to protect the bears. Bush's Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne had ruled that polar bears were threatened, not endangered, because they faced no immediate threat of extinction. Sullivan rejected that notion and asked Interior to, quote, provide a reasonable interpretation of the definition of an endangered species as applied to its listing determination for the polar bear, unquote. Cassie Siegel, a lawyer for the Center for Biological Diversity, which challenged the listing with other groups, said Sullivan's move might lead to an endangered listing. It opens the door for the Obama administration to break with the flawed decision and policies of the Bush administration, she said. Opponents of full protection for the bears have said that projections about the threat to the species have not been based on current population levels, but on expectations of melting sea ice. The Interior Department would not comment on the case as it is still in litigation. It has until December 23rd to reply to the judge. And in other news from Washington, D.C., the Environmental Protection Agency has rejected a ban on toxic lead fishing gear. Agency refuses to address preventable poisoning that kills millions of birds and wildlife every year. Ignoring long-established science on the dangers of lead poisoning in the wild, the Environmental Protection Agency has denied a petition to ban toxic lead fishing sinkers that frequently kill loons, swans, cranes, and other wildlife. A coalition of conservation, hunting, and veterinary groups had petitioned the EPA in August to ban lead in fishing tackle and in bullets and shot for hunting. The agency issued a partial denial of the portion of the petition dealing with the regulation of lead ammunition in September and has now issued its full determination, which also denies the portion of the petition for fishing sinkers. Spent lead from ammunition and lost fishing tackle needlessly poison, kill, and harm millions of wild birds and other animals every year and endanger public health. The EPA seems to have lost its will to regulate toxic substances, even in the face of overwhelming scientific information about the harm to wildlife and threats to human health, said Michael Fry, director of conservation advocacy at the American Bird Conservancy. The EPA's failure to act is inexcusable given what we know about how toxic lead is to wildlife and the extensive science linking lead poisoning in wildlife to ammunition and fishing weights, said Jeff Miller, conservation advocate for the Center for Biological Diversity. There are plenty of safe and available alternatives to lead products for these outdoor sports, so there's no reason for this poisoning to continue. And I want to assure you that while Uncle Dennis is a fisherman, I try to use non-lead weights made of tungsten for fishing. In August, the Center for Biological Diversity, American Bird Conservancy, and other groups formally petitioned the EPA under the Toxic Substances Control Act to ban lead in bullets and shot for hunting, as well as lead in fishing tackle. The petition referenced nearly 500 peer-reviewed scientific papers illustrating the widespread dangers of lead poisoning from these sources. More than 70 organizations in 27 states are supporting the lead ban, including groups representing birders, hunters, zoologists, scientists, American Indians, physicians, veterinarians, and public employees. Cranes, ducks, swans, loons, geese, and other wild waterfowl ingest lead fishing sinkers lost in lakes and rivers, mistaking them for food or grit, and thousands of them are poisoned each year. The EPA has a clear authority under the Toxic Substances Control Act to regulate lead in any way it sees fit, and it is not up to the petitioners to formulate the least burdensome regulation, said Fry. The scientific data in the petition demonstrated the need for regulation to prevent the poisoning of wildlife, and it is up to the EPA to formulate the proper regulations. Ironically, the EPA declared last week National Lead Poisoning Prevention Week to raise awareness about the dangers of lead exposure to humans. Major efforts to control lead in paint, gasoline, and other products have reduced lead in the environment, but spent lead from hunting and fishing is still a widespread wildlife killer. And we don't need public relations stunts like Lead Poisoning Prevention Week from the nation's EPA. We must have substantive action to prevent the known widespread and unnecessary and ongoing lead poisoning of bald eagles, condors, loons, and other wildlife cherished by all Americans, said Miller. The agency has attempted to punt on this issue, but we're not going to let it walk away from taking action on the preventable poisoning of birds and other animals. Lead is an extremely toxic substance that is dangerous to people and wildlife, even at low levels. Exposure can cause a range of health effects from acute poisoning and death to long-term problems such as reduced reproduction, inhibition of growth, and damage to neurological development. Wildlife is poisoned when animals scavenge on carcasses shot and contaminated with lead bullet fragments, or pick up and eat spent lead shot pellets or lost fishing weights, mistaking them for food or grit. Animals can die a painful death from lead poisoning or suffer for years from its debilitating effects. An estimated 10 to 20 million birds and other animals die each year needlessly from lead poisoning in just the United States. And if you want more information, go to www.abcbirds.org. That's abcbirds.org or www.biologicaldiversity.org. And we have just a moment or two for some more biological diversity news. The Environmental Protection Agency may block mountaintop removal mining. Help it happen. In a huge blow to one of the biggest mountaintop removal projects ever proposed, and after nearly 4,200 comments were filed by the Center for Biological Diversity supporters, the Environmental Protection Agency has recommended against approving the devastating Spruce Mountaintop Removal coal mine. The agency advised its Office of Water to deny a Clean Water Act permit for the mine proposed in Logan County, West Virginia. The recommendation was based on grounds that would bury almost 7 miles of streams and pollute many more miles of nearby waterways after literally blowing off the top of a mountain to mine for coal. The proposed Spruce mine would also destroy 2,300 acres of forest if the Office of Water follows the EPA's recommendations later this year. It will be the first time the agency has retroactively denied a mountaintop permit. Pollution from mountaintop removal mining has been found to cause deformities and reproductive failure in downstream wildlife and has been associated with cancer clusters in human communities exposed to high levels of coal mining activities. Mountaintop removal coal mine has already destroyed more than 500 mountains, more than 1 million acres of hardwood forest, and more than 2,000 miles of streams in Appalachia. And studies have found that oil spills is devastating the imperiled bluefin tuna, confirming the Center for Biological Diversity's worst fears for one of the Gulf's most amazing fish. A scientific study has estimated that the BP oil spill killed 20% of the area's juvenile Atlantic bluefin tuna. Already, overfishing has caused the fish's western population, whose only known breeding grounds are in the Gulf, to decline by more than 80%. So the center filed a petition to protect the tuna in May, just after it spawned in the middle of the worst oil spill in U.S. history. This September, the National Marine Fisheries Service reacted positively to our petition, announcing it will consider Endangered Species Act status for the tuna. It would require the feds to protect the fish from threats like offshore drilling, as well as banning bluefin importation and compelling the set-aside of federally protected critical habitat. The bluefin tuna is a massive fish, up to 13 feet long, weighing up to a ton, and among the fastest of all species, can swim up to 55 miles an hour. This year's oil spill has proven one of the worst bluefin threats ever. And a suit has been filed to save California and Nevada species from off-road vehicles. In defense of bighorn, sage grouse, trout, and other imperiled plants and animals, the Center for Biological Diversity has sued the U.S. Forest Service for allowing off-road vehicles in sensitive areas along the California-Nevada border. In March, the agency designated 220 miles of new motorized routes in the area's Humboldt-Toyabe National Forest, routes that cross key habitat for the federally protected Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep and Lahontan cutthroat trout, as well as sage-grouse nesting habitat. Making matters worse, the service's decision allows 49 miles of new routes in federally designated roadless areas, which, as the name implies, are supposed to offer large uninterrupted expanses of roadless land for the sake of both wildlife and people. The Forest Service admits that off-road vehicles can hurt wildlife by disrupting behavior, crushing them, tearing up the habitat, and impairing water quality for fish and frogs. The intrusion of noisy, exhaust-spewing off-road vehicles into roadless areas is completely at odds with the very values for which these areas were protected in the first place, said the center's Rob Moralka. If you want more information, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz and on the web at www.freakradio.org. If you'd like to hear a podcast or download a previous Earth First Update edition, go to the following website, www.h2opodcast.com. That's H, the number 2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And we want to thank the folks at H2O Podcast for recording and archiving those shows for our listeners. And Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening. Do tune in next Thursday for another edition of the Earth First Update.